Now he had a clear field, and his wristwatch gave him another 20 minutes. He hurried forward. He wanted to keep well clear of the control room and Sergio Caporetti. Using the forward companionway, he dropped down to the working deck, fumbling out his duplicate set of keys. Warning. Explosives. No unauthorized entry. He unlocked the door, and laying the shotgun flat on the deck, he lifted a 25-pound drum of plastique down from its rack. In his haste, he tore a fingernail on the lid of the drum, but hardly felt the pain. He uncoiled a 6-foot length of the soft, dark, toffee-coloured material and slung it around his neck. Next, he selected a cardboard box of pencil time fuses. He read the label. 14-minute delay, that's about right. Blood from his torn nail left brown blotches on the cardboard as he took 4 of the pencils from the box, picked up the shotgun and hurried aft. The jet engine whine of the cyclone mounted deafeningly as he came closer to it. Tracy was curled on the bare steel plating of the deck, with Johnny's jacket folded under her head. She was in a fatigue-drugged sleep, so deep as to be almost death-like. Every few minutes, Johnny interrupted his restless patrol of the conveyor room to stand over her and look down on her unconscious form. His worried expression softened a little each time he studied her pale, lovely face. Once he stooped over her and tenderly lifted a strand of dark hair from her cheek before resuming his pacing up and down the narrow cabin. Each time he reached the door of the conveyor room, he glanced through the tiny window. The glass had resisted his attempts to smash it with one of the spanners. He had wanted to open the window to call for help, but his efforts had not marked the thick armoured glass. There was no way out of the cabin. Johnny had tried every possible outlet. The apertures for the conveyor system were guarded at one end by the furnace and at the other by moving machinery which would ferociously chew to tatters anyone who became entangled in it. They were caged securely, and Johnny paced his cage. Again he stopped before the peephole, but this time he flung himself at the door with clenched fists. The steel plate smeared the skin from his knuckles as he hammered on it, and the pain sobered him. He pressed his face to the glass and through it watched Benedict van der Bael enter the conveyor room and, without glancing at the window, cross to the cyclone. Benedict laid aside the shotgun he carried and for a moment stood looking up at the thick steel pipe that carried the gravel down from the deck pumps above. As he lifted the thick rope of plastique from around his neck, Johnny knew exactly what he was going to do. He watched in fascination as Benedict mounted the steel ladder up the side of the cyclone. Hanging with one hand to the ladder, Benedict reached out with the other and clumsily tied the rope of plastique around the gravel pipe. It hung there like a necklace about the throat of some obscene prehistoric monster. "You bastard! You murdering bloody swine!" Johnny shouted, and again he beat on the steel door with his fists. But the thickness of the door and the whine of the cyclone drowned his voice. Benedict showed no sign of hearing him, but Tracy sat up and looked about her blearily. Then she came to her feet, and staggering to the roll and pitch of the ship, she went to Johnny and pressed her face to the window beside her. Benedict was sticking the time pencils into the soft, dark explosive. He used all 4 fuses, taking no chances on a misfire. "What's he doing?" Tracy asked after she had recovered from the surprise of recognizing her brother. "He's going to cut the pipe and let Kingfisher pump herself full of gravel." "Sink her?" Tracy's voice was sharp with alarm. "She'll pump water and gravel into herself at pressures that will tear away all the inner bulkheads." "This one?" Tracy patted the steel plate. "Well, it'll pop like a paper bag. God, you have no idea of the power in those pumps." "No," Tracy shook her head. "He's my brother. He won't do it, Johnny. He couldn't murder us." "By the time he's finished," Johnny contradicted her grimly, "Kingfisher will be lying in 200 feet of water. Her hull will be packed so tightly with gravel that it will be like a block of cement. We and everything in her, including his little machine, will be so flattened as to be unrecognizable. It will cost millions to salvage Kingfisher, and no one will care that much." "No, not Benedict," Tracy was almost pleading. "He's not that bad." Johnny interrupted her brusquely. "He could get away with it. It's a good try, his best chance. encase all the evidence against him in concrete, and bury it deep. No. No, Benedict. Tracy was watching her brother as he climbed down the cyclone ladder and picked up the shotgun. Please, Benedict, don't do it. Almost as if he had heard her, Benedict turned suddenly and saw the two faces at the window. The shock of guilt held him rigid for a moment as he stared at them, Tracy's pale lips forming words he could not hear, Johnny's eyes burning with accusation. Benedict dropped his eyes. He made a gesture that was indecisive, almost pathetic. He looked up at the fused and charged rope of explosive, and then he grinned, a sardonic twitching of the lips, and he stumbled out of the cyclone room and was gone. "He'll come back," whispered Tracy. "He won't let it happen." "I wouldn't bet on that if I were you," said Johnny. Benedict reached Kingfisher's rail and clung to it. He looked out to where Wild Goose bobbed and hung on the swells. He saw Hugo's face as a white blob behind the wheeled house window, but as the little trawler began closing in for the pickup, Benedict waved it away. He glanced at his watch again, then looked back anxiously at the bridge. The long minutes dragged by. Where the hell was the Italian? Benedict could not leave him, not while he still had that diamond, not while he could stop the dredge pumps and release the prisoners locked below. Again, Benedict checked his watch. 12 minutes since he had set the time pencils. He must go back and find Caporetti. He started back along the rail, and at that moment Sergio appeared on the wing of the bridge. He shouted a question at Benedict that was lost in the wind. "Come on!" frantically Benedict beckoned to him. "Come on, hurry!" With another last look about the bridge, Sergio ran to the ladder and climbed down to deck level. "Where are my boys?" he shouted at Benedict. "Why are nobody at the con? What do you do with them?" "They're all right," Benedict assured him. He had turned to the rail and was signalling Wild Goose to come alongside. "Where they?" demanded Sergio. "Where my boys?" "I sent them to..." Benedict's reply was cut off as Kingfisher's deck jarred under their feet. The explosion was a dull concussion in her belly, and Sergio's jaw hung open. Benedict backed away from him along the rail. "Filth!" Sergio's jaw snapped closed. His whole body appeared to swell with anger. "You killed them, dirty pig! You kill my boys! You kill Johnny, the girl!" "Keep away from me," Benedict braced himself against the rail, leaving both hands free to use the gun. Not even Sergio would advance into the deadly blank eyes of those muzzles. He paused uncertainly. "I'll blow your guts all over the deck," Benedict warned him, and his forefinger was hooked around the trigger. They stared at each other, and the wind fluttered their hair and tore at their clothing. "Give me those diamonds," Benedict commanded. And when Sergio stood unmoving, he went on urgently, "Don't be a hero, Caporetti. I can gun you down and take them anyway. Give them to me, and our deal is still on. You'll come with us. I'll get you out of here, I swear it." Sergio's expression of outrage faded. A moment longer, he hesitated. "Come on, Caporetti, we haven't got much time." It may have been his imagination, but to Benedict it seemed that Kingfisher's action in the water had altered. She was sluggish to meet the swells, and her role was more pronounced. "Okay," said Sergio, and began unbuttoning his jacket. "You win. I give you." Benedict relaxed with relief, and Sergio thrust his hand into his jacket and stepped towards him. He grasped the canvas bag by its neck and brought it out, held like a cosh. Sergio was close to him, too close for Benedict to swing the shotgun onto him. Sergio's expression became savage. His intentions blazed in his dark eyes as he lifted the canvas bag and poised himself to deliver a blow at Benedict's head. But he had not reckoned with the extraordinary reflexes of the natural athlete he was facing. As Sergio launched the blow, Benedict rolled his shoulders and head away from it, lifting the butt of the shotgun as a guard. Sergio's wrist struck the seasoned walnut, and he grunted with the pain. His fingers opened nervelessly, and the canvas bag flew from his grip, glancing off Benedict's temple, and flew on down the deck, sliding to stop against one of the compressed air tanks 30 feet away. Benedict danced back, dropping the barrels of the shotgun until Sergio looked into the muzzles. "Hold it, you bastard!" Benedict snarled at him. "You've made your choice. Now let's see what your guts look like." Sergio was hugging his injured wrist to his belly, crouching over it. Benedict was backing away to where the bag lay against the tank. His face was flushed and hectic with anger, but he kept darting side glances at the canvas bag. At that moment, Kingfisher took another wave over her bows, and the water came swooshing down the deck, picking up the bag and washing it towards the scuppers. "Hey, look out!" Sergio shouted. "The bag! It's going!" Benedict lunged for it, sprawling full length. With his free hand, he grabbed the sodden canvas as it was disappearing over the side. But he was 30 feet away from Sergio, and he still held the shotgun in his other fist. Sergio could not hope to reach him without getting both charges of buckshot in his belly. Instead, Sergio spun round and sprinted back along the deck towards the bridge. Benedict was on his knees, frantically stuffing the bag of diamonds into the side pocket of his jacket and shouting after Sergio, "Stop! Stop or I'll shoot!" Sergio did not look back nor check his run, and Benedict had the bag in his pocket, and now both hands were free. He lifted the shotgun and tried to balance himself against Kingfisher's wallowing motion as he aimed. At the shot, Sergio stumbled slightly, but kept on running. He reached the ladder and went up it. Again Benedict aimed, and the shotgun clapped dully in the wind. This time a spasm of pain shuddered through Sergio's big body, and he froze on the ladder. Benedict fumbled in his pocket for fresh shells, but before he could reload, Sergio had begun climbing again. Benedict broke the gun and thrust the shells into the breech. He snapped the gun closed and looked up just as Sergio disappeared through the storm doors, and the two shots that Benedict loosed after him merely pockmarked the paintwork and starred the glass of the wheelhouse. "He's a stupid bastard," Hugo watched from the wheelhouse of Wild Goose. "He has gone berserk." Hugo had heard the explosion and seen the shooting. 15 years is enough, but not the rope as well. He swung the wheel, and Wild Goose sheered in towards Kingfisher's side. Peering through the spray and salt-smattered windows, he saw Benedict drag himself to his feet and start after Sergio along the deck. Hugo snatched the electric loud hailer from its bracket and pulled open the side window of this wheelhouse, holding the hailer to his lips. "Hey, you stupid bastard, have you gone mad? What the hell are you doing?" Benedict glanced down at the trawler, then ignored it to give all his attention to reloading the gun. He kept going back along the deck, following Sergio to finish him off. "You get us all strung up, you fool!" Hugo called through the loud hailer. "Leave him! Let's get out of here!" Benedict kept scrambling and slipping towards Kingfisher's bridge. "I am leaving! Now! Do you hear me? You can stew in your own pot! I am getting out!" Benedict checked and looked down at the trawler. He shouted and pointed at the bridge. Hugo caught one word. "Diamonds!" "All right, friend, do what you like. I'll see you around," Hugo hailed, and hit the trawler's throttle wide open. The roar of the diesels and the churning of her propeller convinced Benedict. "Hugo, wait for me, I'm coming!" He scampered back to the ladder and started down it. Hugo throttled back and brought Wild Goose in neatly under the ladder. "Jump!" he shouted through the hailer, and obediently Benedict jumped to hit the foredeck heavily. The shotgun flew from his hands to fall into the water alongside. Benedict cast one longing glance after the gun, then crawled to his feet and limped back to the wheelhouse. Already Wild Goose was plunging away into the wind, but as Benedict entered the wheelhouse, Hugo turned on him with his pink albino face set in a snarl of rage. "What the hell have you done, you bastard? You lied to me! What was that explosion?"
"Explosion? I don't know. What explosion?"
Hugo hit him a stinging, open-handed blow across the cheek. "We agreed no killing, and you put us all on the spot!" Hugo's attention was focused completely on Benedict, who had backed into the furthest corner of the wheelhouse. He massaged the dark red finger marks that stained his cheek.
"You set scuttling charges in Kingfisher, didn't you? You dirty son of a bitch! God, I hate to think what you have done with Lance and the girl!"
Outside, the storm was nearing its climax. A rain squall swept down on Wild Goose, sure sign that the wind must soon drop. Automatically, Hugo switched on the rotating wipers to clear the rain from the screen as he continued to harangue Benedict.
"I saw you trying to murder the Italian. Christ, what for? He's one of us. Am I next on your list?"
"He had the diamonds," mumbled Benedict. "I was trying to get them from him."
And Hugo's expression changed. He turned away from the wheel and stared at Benedict.
You haven't got the diamonds? Is that what you are saying? His tone was almost hurt.
I tried. He wouldn't.
And Hugo left the wheel and was across the wheelhouse like a white leopard. He grabbed the front of Benedict's coat and screamed into his face.
You left the diamonds! You stick my head in a noose and I get nothing out of it!
He was trembling with rage, and his pale eyes bulged from their sockets. Looking into those eyes, Benedict realized his own danger. In the time it had taken him to leave Kingfisher's deck and reach the wheelhouse of the trawler, he had decided to let Hugo think that Sergio still had the diamonds. Squeamish as Hugo appeared to be about drowning Johnny and Tracy, despite his repeated demands for no killing, Benedict knew intuitively that Hugo had no intention of splitting £1 million worth of diamonds with him. Once Hugo was certain that Benedict had the stones on board, Benedict knew there was no chance that he would reach South America alive. The crossing might take weeks. The crew of the trawler were in Hugo's pay and loyal only to him. Benedict must sleep, and they would take him in the night. On the other hand, of course, Benedict had no intention of splitting £1 million worth of diamonds with Hugo Cramer. He let his voice whine as he cringed in Hugo's grip. I tried. Sergio had them. He wouldn't. That's why I shot him. Hugo drew back his hand to slap Benedict again. Benedict twisted slightly and drove his knee into Hugo's crutch, sending him staggering back across the wheelhouse, clutching himself between the legs and whimpering with the pain. Right, Cramer, Benedict spoke softly. That's a little lesson for you. Behave yourself and you'll get your $50,000 on the other side of the Atlantic. They stared at each other. Hugo Cramer weak and pale with agony, Benedict standing tall and arrogant again. Treat me gently, Cramer. I'm your meal ticket. Remember it. Hugo gaped at him. The positions had reversed so swiftly. He pulled himself upright, and his voice was thick with agony, but humble. I am sorry, Mr. Van der Bael. I lost my temper. It's been a hell of a... Skipper! Ahead! The warning was shouted by the coloured crewman, Hunsie. Hugo stumbled to the untended wheel and peered out into the storm. Wild Goose was shooting down another slope of green water. And just ahead of her bows, Hugo saw one of the huge yellow buoys that Kingfisher had laid down and then abandoned. It was held captive in the trough of the swells by the anchor cable. The cable was drawn as tight as a rod of steel across the trawler's bows, lifted just above the surface of the water. Shivering drops of water flew from it under the tension of the buoy's drag. Oh, God! Hugo spun the wheel and threw Wild Goose's engine into reverse. But she was racing down the swell, and her speed was unchecked as the cable scraped harshly along her keel. Then came the harsh banging and clattering of the drive shaft as the cable fouled the propeller, followed by a crack as the shaft snapped. Wild Goose's engine screamed into overrev as the load was lifted from it. Hugo shut the throttle, and there was silence in the wheelhouse. Wild Goose swung beam onto the seas, which came boiling in over her deck. Without her propeller, she was transformed from a husky little sea creature to a piece of driftwood at the mercy of each current and the whim of the wind. Hugo's head swung slowly until he was looking downwind to where the massive shapes of Thunderbolt and Suicide just showed through the rain squall.
"Cover your ears tight,"
Johnny Lance pressed Tracy against the bulkhead, as far from the cyclone room as they could get.
There are 25 pounds of plastique in there. It'll blow like a volcano. He'll have to use short fuse, 14 minutes. We won't have long to wait.
Johnny set Tracy's shoulders squarely against the steel plating and crouched over her, trying to shield her with his own body. They stared into each other's eyes, teeth clenched, the heels of their palms jammed hard over their ears, and they cowered away from the blast that must come. The minutes passed, the longest minutes of Tracy's life. She could not have borne them without screaming hysteria, except for that big hard body covering her. Even with it, she felt her fear mounting steadily during the molasses drip of time. Suddenly the air lunged at her, driving the breath from her lungs. Johnny was thrown heavily against her. The blast sucked at her eardrums and burst in her head so that bright lights flashed across her vision, and she felt the steel plates heave under her shoulders. Then her head cleared, and although her eardrums buzzed and sang, she found, with a leaping relief, that she was still alive. She reached out for Johnny, but he was gone.
In panic, she groped, then opened her eyes. He was lurching down the long conveyor room, and when he reached the locked door at the far end, he pressed his face to the peephole. The fumes of the explosion still filled the cyclone room, a swirling, bluish fog. But through them, Johnny could make out the shambles that was the aftermath. The huge cyclone had been torn from its mountings, and now sagged against the far bulkhead, crushed. It was worth only a single glance before Johnny froze into rigidity at the true horror. The gravel pipe had been severed cleanly just below its juncture with the upper deck. It protruded for 6 feet, but now the force of the jet through it was flicking and whipping it about as though it were not steel, but a rubber garden hose. The jet was a solid 18-inch column, a pillar of brown mud and yellow gravel and seawater that beat against the steel plates of the howl with a hollow, drumming roar. In the few seconds since the explosion, the cyclone room was already half-filled with a slimy, shifting porridge that rushed from wall to wall with the movement of the ship. It was like some monstrous jellyfish, which each second gathered weight and strength. Tracy reached Johnny's side, and he placed his arm around her shoulders. She looked through the armoured glass, and he felt her body stiffen. At that moment, the yellow monster spread over the window, obscuring it completely. Johnny felt the first straining of the steel plates under his hands. They fluttered and bulged, then began to protest aloud at the intolerable pressure. A seam started, and a fine jet of filthy water hissed from the gap and soaked icily through Johnny's jersey. "Get back!" Johnny dragged Tracy away from the squeaking, groaning bulkhead. Back along the narrow conveyor room they stumbled, moving with difficulty, for the deck beneath their feet was slanting as Kingfisher began to lean under the increasing weight in her belly. Still holding Tracy, he reached the locked door and resisted the futile desire to attack it with his bare hands. Instead, he forced his brain to work, tried to anticipate the sequence of events that would lead to the final destruction of Kingfisher and all those aboard her. Benedict had left the other entrance to the cyclone room wide open. Already that viscous mass of mud and water must be spreading rapidly through the lower levels of the howl, following always the avenue of least resistance, finding the weak spots and bursting through them. If the walls of the conveyor room held against the pressure, the rest of the howl would be filled, and they would be enfolded in the tentacles of that great yellow monster, a small bubble of air trapped within it and taken down with it, when it returned to the depths from which it had come. Would the bulkheads of the conveyor room hold? The answer came almost immediately, in the squeal of metal against metal and the crackle of springing rivets. The monster had found the weak spot, the aperture through the drying furnace into the conveyor, ripping away the fragile baffles, bursting through the furnace in a cloud of steam. It gushed into the conveyor room, bringing with it the sewage stench of deep-sea mud. Kingfisher made another sluggish roll, so different from her usual spry action, and the mud came racing down the tunnel in a solid knee-high wall. It slammed both of them back against the steel door with a shocking strength, and the feel of it was cold and loathsome as something long dead and putrefied. Kingfisher rolled back, and the mud slithered away, bunched itself against the far bulkhead, then charged at them again. Waist-deep it struck them, and tried to suck them back with the next roll. Tracy was screaming now, nerves and muscles reaching their breaking point. She was clinging to Johnny, coated to the waist in stinking ooze, her eyes and mouth wide open in terror as she watched the mud building up for its next assault. Johnny groped for some hold to anchor them. They must keep on their feet to survive that next rush of mud. He found the locking handle of the door and braced himself against it, holding Tracy with all his strength. The mud came again, silently, murderously. It burst over their heads and punched them with stunning force against the plating. Then it sucked back once more and left them down on their knees, anchored only by Johnny's grip on the locking handle. Tracy was vomiting the foul mud, and it filled her ears and eyes and nostrils, clogging them so that it bubbled at her breath. Johnny could feel her weakening in his arms, her struggles becoming more feeble as she tried to regain her feet. His own strength was going. It needed his last reserve to drag them both upright. The locking handle turned in his fingers, spinning open. The steel door against which he was braced fell away, so that he staggered backwards without support, still clutching Tracy. There was just a moment to recognise the big reassuring bulk of Sergio Caporetti beside him, and feel an arm like the trunk of a pine tree steady him, before the rush of mud down the conveyor room hit them and knocked all three of them down, sending them swirling and rolling end over end before its strength dissipated in the new space beyond the conveyor room door. Johnny pulled himself up the bulkhead. He had lost Tracy. Dazed but desperate, he looked for her, mumbling her name. He found her swilling aimlessly in the waist-deep mud, floating on her face. He took a handful of muddy hair and lifted her face out, but the mud had hold of his legs, pulling him off balance as it surged back and forth.
"Sergio, help!" he croaked. "For God's sake, Sergio!"
And Sergio was there, lifting her like a child in his arms and wading to the ladder that led to the deck above. The mud knocked Johnny down again, and when he surfaced, Sergio was climbing steadily up the ladder. Despite the mud and water that blurred Johnny's eyesight, he could see that Sergio's wide back, from shoulders to hips, was speckled with dozens of punctures, as though he had been stabbed repeatedly with a knitting needle. From each tiny wound oozed droplets of blood that spread like brown ink on the blotting paper of his sodden jacket. At the head of the companionway, Sergio turned, still holding Tracy in his arms. He stood like a colossus, looking down at Johnny, wallowing and slipping in the mud below.
"Hey, Alance, go switch off your bloody machine. She drowned my ship. I sail her myself now, the right way. No bloody fancy machine."
Johnny steadied himself against the bulkhead and called up at him.
"Sergio, what happened to Benedict van der Bale? Where is he?"
"I think he go with Wild Goose, but first he shoot the hell out of me, not half. Fix your machine, no time for talk."
And he was gone, still carrying Tracy. Another rush of mud carried Johnny down the flooded passage and threw him against the door to the control room. Already his body seemed to be one aching bruise, and still the battering continued as he tried to unlock and open the control room door. At last, using the suck of the mud to help him, he yanked it open and went in with a burst of yellow slime following him and flooding the compartment shoulder deep. Clinging to the console of the computer, he reached up and punched the master control buttons. "Dredge, stop. Dredge engines, stop. Main engines, manual. Navigation system manual, all programs abort." Instantly, the roar from the severed dredge pipe, which had echoed through the ship during all their strivings, dwindled as though some vast waterfall had dried. Then there was silence, though only comparative silence, for the howl still groaned and squeaked at the heartbreaking burden it now carried, and the mud slopped and thudded against the plating. Weak and sick, Johnny clung to the console. He was shivering with cold, and every muscle in his body felt bruised and strained. Suddenly, the ship changed her motion, heaving under his feet like a harpooned whale as she swung broadside to the storm. Johnny roused himself with alarm. The journey back through the flooded passages to the companionway was an agony of mind and body, for Kingfisher was now behaving in a strange and unnatural way. The scene that awaited Johnny as he dragged himself onto the bridge chilled his soul as the icy mud had chilled his body. Thunderbolt and Suicide lay less than a furlong off Kingfisher's starboard quarter. Both islands were wreathed in sheets of spray that fumed from the surf that was breaking like cannon fire on the cliffs. The maniacal flute of the wind joined with the drum of the surf to produce a symphony fit for the halls of hell. But above this devil's music, Sergio Caporetti bellowed, "We got no power on port main engine!" Johnny turned to him. Sergio was hunched over the wheel, and Tracy lay on the deck at his feet like a discarded doll.
"The water, she kill port main!"
Sergio was pumping the engine telegraph. Then, abandoning the effort, he looked over the side. The reeking white cliffs were closer now, much closer, as though you could reach out a hand to them. The ship was drifting down rapidly on the wind. Sergio spun the wheel full port lock, trying to bring Kingfisher's head round to meet the sea and the wind. She was rolling as no ship was ever meant to roll, hanging over at the limit of each swing, so that the wheelhouse windows seemed but a few feet from the crests of the green waves. She hung like that, as though she meant never to come upright again. Then, sluggishly, reluctantly, she swung back. Speeding up, as she reached the perpendicular, and the great mass of mud and water in her hull shifted and slammed her over on her other side, pinning her like that for eternal seconds before she could struggle upright again for the cycle to be repeated. Sergio held the wheel at full lock, but still Kingfisher wallowed down towards the cliffs of Thunderbolt and Suicide. The wind had her the way a dog carries a bone in its teeth. Under half power and with her decks awash, Kingfisher could not break that grip. Johnny was a helpless spectator, held oar-bound, so he could not break away even to succour Tracy, who was still lying on the deck. He saw everything with a supernatural clarity, from the dribbling little shot-holes in Sergio's back to the ponderous, irresistible rush of the white water up the cliffs that loomed so close alongside.
"She no answer help. She too sick,"
Sergio spoke now in conversational tones, which carried with surprising clarity through the uproar of the elements.
"All right, then. We go the other way. We take the gap."
For a moment, Johnny did not understand. Then he saw it. Kingfisher's bows were coming up to the narrow opening between the two islands. A passage less than 100 yards wide at its narrowest point, where the vicious cross-currents met head-on and leapt 50 feet into the air as they collided. Here the surface was obscured by a thick froth of spindrift that heaved and humped up as though the ocean were fighting for breath under the thick cream-coloured blanket.
"No!" Johnny shook his head, staring at the hideous passage. "We won't make it, Sergio. We won't do it."
But already Sergio was spinning the wheel from lock to lock, and, unbelievably, Kingfisher was responding. Helped now by the wind, she came round slowly, seeming to brush her bows across the white cliff of Thunderbolt, and she steadied her swing and aimed at the gap. It was then that Johnny saw it for the first time.